This is a Rabble Podcast Network show.
New voices in your head.
It's Radio
Free
Radio.
You're listening to Red Eye on Vancouver Cooperative Radio, CFRO 100.5 FM.
In June this year, a fleet of four ships set sail for Gaza to deliver humanitarian aid. This included medical supplies, solar panels, and other essential materials denied to Palestinians under the Israeli blockade. Robert Lovelace was one of those on board Freedom Flotilla 3. It's the second time he's attempted to reach Gaza by boat. Lovelace is retired chief of the Ardoc Algonquin First Nation and a professor in global development studies at Queen's University. He's going to be in Vancouver this coming Friday to speak about the parallels he sees between Israel and Canada as settler colonial states on occupied indigenous land. Robert Lovelace joins me by phone this morning from Ontario. Hello, Bob.
Hello.
Now, you weren't allowed to reach Gaza. What happened after the Israelis seized the boat?
Well, they seized the boat the morning of July 28th, about 2 o'clock in the morning, and they were able to overpower us. We did put up some resistance, but nonviolent resistance, and then they took control of the bridge, took over the ship, and sailed it with all of us on board to Ashdod, which is a port in Israel. We had actually been just in the shipping lanes off of Suez. We were much closer to Egypt, and we were about 100 nautical miles away from Gaza.
And then you spent time in a detention center before you returned to Canada, is that right?
Yes, we were placed in Devon Prison after going through strip searches and body searches and interrogation.
Why is it important for you as an Indigenous activist to make common cause with Palestinians?
Well, colonialism is a worldwide scourge. It's not something that's just located here, not just something that's located in Palestine, but colonialism is an ideological process that's been going on for some time, and you know, this modern age of colonialism affects probably about, well, it really affects the entire world, but in terms of oppression and the removal of people from their lands and the destruction of cultures, it really affects about 95% of the world.
You've been quoted as saying that Gaza is the world's largest Indian reservation. Can you explain that?
Yes. It's not just an analogy. There are real similarities between the removal of people from Palestine as refugees and about two-thirds of the population of Gaza are refugees, perhaps even a little bit more. And they were removed from their own land starting in 1948 and really working through the 50s as people, you know, continued to lose access to their farms, they continued to lose access to their homes. And so they ended up going into Gaza, just like people here were driven off their own lands and ended up in Indian reserves. That similarity is also evident, but also the economic conditions. In 2008, Israel was passing some cables back and forth between themselves and the American embassy in Tel Aviv, and in one of those cables it said that they were intending to keep the Gaza Strip at the lowest possible economic sort of viability, just above a humanitarian disaster. And that's very much like what has happened in northern Ontario to places like Attawapiskat, to places like that are in the Ring of Fire, that these places have been kept just really at the verge of a humanitarian disaster. And I would even say that with suicide rates, with the poverty and the unemployment, and the lack of access to the land itself, that Canadian government has kept these communities at the lowest possible economic position and viability.
Now, speaking about economics, I guess one of the most important reasons for the Freedom Flotillas to try to enter Gaza is to break that Israeli blockade that has left Gaza economically crippled. What would be an equivalent situation in Canada?
Well, equivalent situation is really much like blockading Aboriginal people from using their traditional territories to harvest resources. Big Trout Lake is a good example of that, where they receive enough money every year to build two or three houses, but they're surrounded by a forest. But the Ontario Ministry of Natural Resources has blockaded them from cutting those forests and bringing in sawmills and developing a housing industry of their own for their own reserve. Opening up Gaza is really important. Gaza is the only port for what's left of Palestine. The West Bank does not have any access out of the West Bank except through Israel or through Jordan. And so Gaza is the Palestinians' door to the world. And by blockading it, it has shut down all of the economic possibilities for both the West Bank and for Gaza.
When I was listening to you giving that example of the nation that you were talking about surrounded by forests that they couldn't use, it came to my mind that I think the situation is the same for fishers in Gaza, that they can't go out and fish. Am I correct?
Yeah, that's correct. And that was certainly the case in British Columbia for a very long time, where Aboriginal people were restricted from fishing their traditional fisheries and even commercial fisheries. But in Gaza, fishermen are only allowed to go out for three kilometers. And if they go out beyond that, then the Israeli Navy shoots at them.
I want to look a little bit at how there are parallels at the administrative level between how Israel administers its occupied territories and how Canada administers First Nations living on reserve. Can you talk about that a little bit?
The Hudson's Bay Company was always the charter was always a hallmark of administrative colonialism in Canada, because it gave that corporation the right to set up courts, to judge people, and to prosecute, not only prosecute them, but punish them if they broke British law. The Indian Act itself is a form of administrative colonialism in that it determines who is an Indian and who is not. Section 35 is the same way. It's a form of administrative colonialism that determines who has access to rights and who doesn't, who's going to be recognized as those who can sit at the negotiation table and those who can't. In Gaza, it's a little bit different. There is that process of having an ID and having being identified as a Palestinian or as a non-Israeli. But there is also the process of administrative colonialism, which is done sort of structurally by organizing the geography where only Israelis can travel on certain roads, and those road systems are the ones that connect the economic viability of the region, where Palestinians are not allowed to travel on those roads. Urban planning and checkpoints control the mobility of people in Gaza, the same way mobility was controlled by the pass system under the Indian Act years ago. So these are the ways that administrative colonialism works and whether they're being applied in Gaza and Canada, you know, sort of in parallel. I don't know if I can make that argument, but I can certainly, you know, see that this process of administrative colonialism, both in process and in structure, is being applied in both places.
We've been talking both about current-day parallels, but also about parallels in the past, and I'm wondering, for you as a First Nations person, when you look at Israel today and then think about what happened to First Nations people maybe 100, 150 years ago, if you see a parallel there, and I'm thinking particularly about settlers. There are settlers now in the occupied territories.
Yes. My own community is in a watershed of the Ottawa River, and so in fact, where I live, where I'm talking to you from right now, is at the height of land. So when a raindrop falls here, it flows all the way down to the nation's capital. And this area was settled about 160 years ago, and it was settled by Scots-Irish, who were the cheapest of labor in Europe, and they were driven out of Europe. And they were settled here, and they literally cut the forest down, which removed everything that our people depended upon. They literally took the best of the pine, and then what was left they burnt into ash and sold as a product, which was then shipped to Europe as potash. The process is a lot the same now with settler colonialism. I could give you an example. You know, many examples of how our people were taken off the land. They weren't given any right to own land or to have private land where settlers were. In Palestine, what's happened is that settlements continue to encroach on Palestinian orchards. The idea that Palestinians have wasted the land, that they haven't developed it. Much of Israel now looks like Southern California, and the water that's being used to keep the grass green and the flowers blooming, that has all been taken away from Palestinian lands and diverted back into the Israeli settlements and Israel proper. So the encroachment of settlement has literally reduced the amount of Palestinian land by something like 80%. We're right now, the Algonquins of Ontario have been involved in a land claim negotiation for the last 25 years. And what they're on the verge of agreeing to, our band has opted out of that, by the way, but what the Algonquins of Ontario are on the verge of agreeing to is 1.3% of our traditional territory. And I think the Palestinians find themselves in a similar position of continuing to lose land until they have only little postage stamps of reserves to live on.
It's been great to talk to you this morning, Bob. Thanks so much, and I look forward to your talk here in Vancouver next week.
Good. I'm hoping people will come out, and also Dima Al-Ansari is speaking, as well as Glenn Colfart.
Thank you so much.
Okay, thank you.
I've been speaking with Robert Lovelace. He's retired chief of the Ardoc Algonquin First Nation and a professor in global development studies at Queen's University. He's going to be speaking in Vancouver this coming Friday, November 27th. The event is titled First Nations, Palestinians at the Frontline of Resistance. And it's going to be at 7 p.m. in room 1700 at SFU's downtown campus. And as Bob said, Dima Al-Ansari and Glenn Coulthard are also going to be speaking at the event.